just gonna move the table closer. And we'll like prop it on something. So it's pointing at it.
Maybe not a major.
I know where the soup's dealer.
You know where the soup's dealer.
Yeah. Yeah. Bad rap here, but.
So maybe so once we just get set up. Yeah.
Oh, actually, I was gonna stand up. Does that change?
We're gonna stand up.
Okay. I was thinking about it.
No, it's good. You know what? Stand. Then Maggie's really gonna get good at this.
I'll sort of stand around here.
Do you want to sit here? You don't really have to do this. I can hold it if you want.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
You want headphones, Chris?
No, I've got good levels. This is not for. This is just for Pete. This is posterity.
Yeah. Posterity.
Yeah. Hey, I could hold it.
Erlyn did location sound for how many years?
Oh god, too many.
So if anyone should be doing this properly, it would be Erlyn.
You're doing fine.
Yeah, thanks. Good. I suck at this part. I have to admit, it's always I talk clearly way too much, and so I am the worst person to do sound. You should. It's
good. Sound people are quiet.
I know, not me. I'm not a good sound person.
See, it's all in the eyebrows.
Okay, so we're all here. I think we've all gathered. And Erlyn is going to talk. It's a sewing machine. It's in mad production mode here for the culture crawl.
Oh, right. Yes,
which is one of the crazy things and beauty things about sharing the space.
Yeah, well, no problem.
So welcome, Erlyn. And tell us what you're going to talk about.
I want to share a little story with you by way of introduction, and then I want to talk about how I became involved with housing issues and how I became a housing activist. Then I want to do a kind of a brief a little bit like what Matt did from his perspective of the forces that he sees at work around housing, and I have a little different perspective, but it's also as a renter. And then some of the slightly wacky solutions that I could see. Not really solutions, but different ways of thinking about housing and how we could address some of the really, some of the deep problems that we have with housing. So that's what I'm going to talk about.
Perfect. Thank you. All right.
So the story I want to share with you is many years ago, when I was a sound, a location sound recordist, I worked on a series. It was actually a couple of, I think it was 2 or 3 hour specials that CBC did about the mafia. And this was at a time when most Canadians didn't think there was a mafia in Canada, and so the series kind of was this big splash about it was investigative journalism and all this stuff. And so we shot in the States, we went to Italy and so forth, and at that time, pre-digital, we were shooting 16mm film. So you shot your film, wrapped it up in the cans, and every few days threw all the cans into like an onion bag, net bag, and shipped it by cargo back to headquarters, which was Toronto. And at one point, we were having a production meeting about how we were going to deal with sometimes very, very sensitive footage coming back into Canada through Canada Customs. So the idea was to come up with a name for the project that when a custom officer saw this bag of stuff, he'd read the title. It was mostly he in those days. And his eyes would glaze over. And he would be not at all interested.
So you had to make a fake name? Or
yeah, so we had to make up a name, like a working title for the project.
Yeah.
So basically came up with the most boring title, like under the radar, nobody will care. They will just go, oh my God, take it away. And the title was The Housing Crisis.
That's awesome.
So, your strategy sounds very similar to when the Canadian government wants to introduce a new bill. Yeah. They ask the people, and just come up with the most boring title possible.
Yeah. C367. Yeah.
So, times have changed.
Yes.
Now we're all pretty enchanted in some way with the housing crisis, and that wouldn't work anymore. But I think back to that, because at that time, I mean, this has got to be like 25 years ago, how it was boring. I mean, first of all, imagine a housing market, a national housing market, no condos.
Right.
Nobody built condos. Nobody knew what a condo was. strata councils like that way of financing and governing that kind of living space didn't exist. And the really out there stuff was a housing co-op. That was like radical. Otherwise you were renting or you bought a house. And so anyway, that's... So I'll tell you a bit about kind of how I got to involved with these things. In 2000, I moved into a building in the West End, sort of turned on to the place by some friends. And so I went to talk to the landlady, and she kind of took me out. So I rented a bachelor apartment at Harwood and Nicola, a place called Bay Towers in the West End. And it was fantastic. There were 38 apartments in the building. There was sort of one row, one side of the building with two bedroom apartments, then two mirror image bachelors in the middle, and then one bedroom apartments on the other side. And it was fantastic because out of the 38 suites, 10 of the apartments were friends, people that I knew and I'd worked with. They were a lot of those folks were staff or and somehow involved with Little Sisters Bookstore, and at that time actually, even before I moved in there, I was making a film about the bookstore. So there were a lot of connections. I knew people in the building, and the building was filled with a lot of long-term tenants, people who had been there for, like, if you'd been there for, like, 10 years, I was like, oh, yeah, you're new.
Wow.
You know, because if people had been there for 19, 20, and actually one of our seniors had lived there for... Well, 40 years. So when you got off the elevator and went into the hall, there were paintings in the hallway and flowers and plants, and people had each other's keys and looked after each other's cats and dogs and took mail. And when you were really, you know, kind of bummed out about something, you know, you could go upstairs and hang out and, you know, get somebody to feed you something and cheer you up. I mean, it was a beautiful, it was a really beautiful community. And there's a lot of, there's a lot of mutual support. There's a lot of trust. The rent was very affordable. I know for all of us as single women, and for some of the guys too, they felt safe there. It really, you didn't feel like you were kind of a stranger in the city. You did know your neighbors. So so in 2005, this all changed when the family that owned this building and a number of other buildings in the West End sold them to corporate landlord, Hollyburn Properties. And we sort of heard rumors that they were nasty, but everybody was hoping for the best, I guess. And I guess maybe 3 months after they took, it was in December 2005, so a few months into the next year, we all, everyone got these letters. Well, I got a letter. And the letter said, you know, we think that the rent you're paying isn't really enough to, you know, for what we're offering and for the area where you're renting. And we're going to raise your rent by 40%. But if you sign this letter and send it back to us, we're nice. We're only going to raise your rent 20%. Just sign. Just sign at the bottom. Okay, that was, you know, that was kind of like, whoa. It was a real shock and quite the uproar. So this is what started our journey together in the building. And right away, and this was the key to our eventual victory, because I still live there. They were not able to get me. The key to it, on my notes here, it's this bold thing in big type. It says, we talk to each other. We talk to each other. Of course, because we were friends, right? They had sort of, like, these kind of landlords have been doing this sort of thing for a long time, and then with the rent evictions and so forth. But when they came up against our building, they came up against a kind of different, little bit of a different community, because we did all talk to each other. We were already a community. And not only that, but we were all involved with, I was shooting on and off for 8 years, this court case that the bookstore was taking through the Canadian courts about censorship, about materials destined for Little Sisters, which is a gay bookstore, being censored, being seized at the border. So we were pursuing a case to the Supreme Court of Canada. So we didn't have any problem taking on this landlord in that way. It didn't, you know, I mean, it turned out it was a pretty formidable effort, but we knew a lot of lawyers. So, and we all talked to each other. That was the key to actually dealing with all of this. So the letters, first of all, we found out very quickly. The letters weren't exactly illegal, but they were very deceptive. They, of course, didn't tell you that by signing the letter, you waived your rights to appeal at the residential tenancy office. Mm-hmm. And most people were so kind of freaked out when they got these letters that they would sign them. And their rent suddenly went up 40%, and the landlord didn't have to do anything except send you the letter. So of course they kept trying it, right? But we all got together and talked, and nobody signed the letter. So a few weeks later, we all got a second letter. And the second letter said, you know, we've been so nice offering you this, you know, this really generous deal on the rent, which, as you must know, is way too low. And all of your neighbors have signed the letter, so why, you know, what is your problem? And well, of course, because we were all talking to each other, nobody had signed the letter. We all knew our neighbors had not signed the letter, and that it was, you know, it was just bogus. But this is the kind of lying, cheating, stealing that is acceptable in these kind of corporate situations. And so anyway, it all carried on. The landlord, a few months later, I go home, I open the door, and there's a piece of paper lying on the floor. I pick it up, and it's an eviction notice, which means in this town, I have 60 days to find other housing and get out. At that time, I think the vacancy rate was like 0.07% or something. It was not that easy to find, you know, and that's a whole issue too around the current regulations around tenant landlord stuff. They tried to do this, what we now call rent evictions. There's a clause in the Residential Tenancy Act that says that if the landlord ever needs vacant possession, that is, they need to do some kind of renovations that require you to actually leave the suite, like to vacate the suite, that for some reason, it's never been explained to me adequately, your tenancy contract is now null and void. Over. If we need to get in and you leave, and in court, their lawyer, because the judge asked them, well, how long are we, like, vacant possession for, like, a week or a month? Like, what would be the sort of the minimum, you know? And the lawyer said, well, for an hour. And I'm sure that's probably why we won the case, because it was just absurd what they were arguing. So they evicted us, there's 10 floors, 4 floors at a time. So it was, you know, if we hadn't been, you know, if we hadn't been pretty solid, they were just picking a, you know, it would have been hard to fight it all together, right? And to share the information and to, you know, build on other people's experiences as they went through the process. So, and I remember one group, I think it was one of the upper, maybe the second, group were evicted. The eviction would have taken effect between Christmas and New Year's. They were such bastards, and they didn't care. You know, they didn't care at all. So anyway, we had to apply. There's just this enormous amount of sort of quasi legal regulatory documentation and work, and we had to prove that they didn't need vacant possession and more. And it turned out quite by accident that my affidavit around the fact that a couple of years previous with the old landlord, I had had my floors refinished. Now, you gotta vacate your place to, you know, like, stuff was piled up in the kitchen on the linoleum and stuff, but all the rest of the apartment is hardwood floors. And so I pretty much put a whole bunch of stuff out in the hallway for 3 days, and then in other people's apartments. And they refinished the floor, and I moved back in. But this was what these landlords, and there were a number of them doing the same thing, would use. Like, we need to refinish your floor. So everything, vacant possession. We need vacant possession. Your tenancy agreement is over. You're out. And now they're free to negotiate whatever rent they want with the new tenant. So it was just a way of booting people out and raising the rent 40%. I mean, they tried to do the easy way with the letter, and if they can't, then they did the rent eviction. So my affidavit, which is, I got my floors refinished, I didn't have to move out, didn't require breaking the tenancy agreement or vacant possession, became a kind of a key part of our argument. So so people responded in different ways to this challenge. It was, I know you've, most of you have had some pretty stressful experiences around your housing. And honestly, we would talk and go, you know, taking a censorship case to the Supreme Court of Canada, piece of cake. Mm-hmm. Getting evicted from your home, whoa. Mm-hmm. Heavy. Like, in a way that the other stuff, you know, you're committed to, but it hits you in a different way. And it's very emotional, and it's, some people, you know, so people responded differently. Some people were just kind of terrified, and they, Yeah, they left. And some, you know, for some reason or other. And the first people to leave because they could not deal with the information overload, with the emotional stress, were our seniors. Mm-hmm. I shot footage all through this, and I shot footage of Margaret, who lived in one of the little bachelor suites on the sixth floor, taking her furniture and, you know, it going onto a van, and she'd lived in the West End for 50 years. All of her cribbage buddies were in the West End. The people, the West End Community Center, her bank, her friends, that was her community, and she had to leave. Now, her family, I met her family, interviewed them, and they were really great people. And they loved Margaret, they wanted to take care of her, she was their mom. And so they had a suite for her to live in Kamloops, where they lived, which was lovely, and they were very, very lovely people. But she lost her community, her day-to-day, the touchstones of her day-to-day life at an age where, I mean, she was in her early 80s. And it was very tough and very, very sad. And anyway, there is a range. So some people left because they just couldn't deal with it. Other people just thought, this is going to be way too much of a hassle. Like, I think I'll just, you know, get ahead of the curve and go find somewhere else. And you know, that was, people made those decisions, and that was fine. And then there's a group of us, pretty much all of us who were around the bookstore, who decided we were going to fight. We were not going to let these people do. And I think, you know, in retrospect, if they had come to us right at the beginning and said, you know, we've bought the building, it really does need a lot of work. It needs, you know, new fire alarms, and the plumbing probably needs to be redone and so forth. And it's going to be major disruption, and you really do need to think about moving out, and we'll give you 6 months. You know, we all would have been unhappy and kind of freaked out, but yeah, okay, yeah. Give me a couple of free months of rent. It's like, but they didn't do that. They barely dealt with us at all, and when they did, it was in such an arrogant, disrespectful way that they made us all furious. And it was like, you know, fuck you. You know, I mean, they just, it kind of inspired us to resist this, because they were so horrible about how they dealt with the sort of people side of it. And so anyway, we, various things, it took about a year and a half. We ended up in BC Supreme Court after many meetings and dealings with the Residential Tenancy Act, which governs landlord-tenant relations in this province. Housing is provincial for the most part. And the Residential Tenancy Office, which is Metrotown. So every time you had to go to the office, it was this trek out to Metrotown. And there had been an office in the West End. The West End has the highest rates of renters, the highest proportion of renters in the city. 80% of the people who live in the West End rent. They closed down the office in the West End, so now, you know, the Liberals did that back in the 90s, and they also changed the act to make it much more landlord-friendly, as we discovered. So there were deadlines that had to be met, these incredible binders of affidavits and legal documents to back up our arguments, and fortunately, one of our people, and this was somebody who our group didn't know. We met each other over the eviction notices, right? So there was suddenly a kind of whole new, you know, and Sharon Isaac was unemployed at the time, and she's like a terrier when she gets a hold of this, and it's like, you know, she just went after it, and she worked her butt off, and she was one of the people who made it, you know, made it possible for us to sort of carry on this struggle for a year and a half. It felt like a year and a half out of our lives. That's all we ever dealt with. I don't know how we even found time to eat or have a job or anything else. We were just consumed with this. It's just such an enormous amount of work and very tricky and a lot of pitfalls. And so anyway, we went through this Byzantine process and went to BC Supreme Court, where I took great delight in winning a case against their $200 an hour lawyer. And so that kind of put an end to the rent evictions, because when the courts looked at what they were doing at the Residential Tenancy Office, which is a quasi-judicial body, it's a tribunal, it's not a court. The rules of evidence, representation, all that are quite different than they are in a court of law. And when they saw how they were administering their rules and regulations, the Supreme Court of BC was like, you could almost read between the lines. It's like, you've got to be kidding. This is not the intent of this act. I mean, they were just appalled when they saw what was actually going on. And just to note, the Residential Tenancy Act is a regulatory scheme. It is not law, which means that it can be amended and changed without any discussion in any legislature anywhere. It's conveniently kept as this administrative, tribunal-based, quasi-judicial regulatory framework. And it's very hard to change it.
But it essentially governs or sets out the rules of relationships between renters and tenants. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay.
Huh. In much detail.
In the entire province.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There are some exceptions for like trailer parks and various, right. But basically that's the deal. And it is very much skewed towards landlords. Okay. Possibly I'm biased, but that was certainly my opinion about it. So so the results, and I talked a little bit, or I sort of mentioned a little bit, I think that first evening I was here. So I've become a housing activist. Partly what happened is, once we had been through this and won, and got a fair bit of, you know, there's a lot of publicity, there's a lot of people wrote about it in the community papers and the Courier and the West Ender and so forth. And when the same stuff started happening to other apartments, not only in the West End, but really across the city, they were like, talk to the people at Bay Towers. They went through this. They know what to do, right? So we would get phone calls like, they've just evicted us, or they're going to repipe the building, and they're threatening to throw everybody out. Like, what do we do? So, and Sharon actually became quite a resource person. I mean, we all done a bit of it, but she's really taken it on. I think we've all our community of friends and people who took on the struggle with us, we've all been changed by the experience. I have footage of Sharon, who was, can't remember the company, but it's sort of a regional bus company, driver. We were having a potluck up on the top of the building, on the deck in the top of the building, and she's on camera and she's saying, I'm supposed to go talk to this group tomorrow. I've never spoken in public before. I'm totally freaked out. I don't know what I'm gonna do. I you know, and Sharon is now the coordinator of the West End Seniors Network Action Table. She is now the spokesperson for attendance advocacy group. That's the, you know, I mean, she is like out there now, and so her life really, really changed, and what she's doing, and it certainly changed mine too. I'm actually hoping to return to school and look at some of these issues in terms of civil society, social capital. It brought me into becoming very interested in some of the sort of systemic issues, which, by the way, are happening all over the world. These same issues are right on top in right now, in Mexico City, in Karachi, in London. I mean, the whole issue of housing, of affordable, adequate housing for most people, for working people, is worldwide. And I think we did create a really solid community of resistance, and of resources that we could share with other people. So even though it was a nightmare, some good things came out of it. And I, you know, I do sort of gloat a little bit about, you know, anybody who wanted to stay. I mean, people have, since then, their lives changed. They moved, you know, out of the building and stuff. But any of us who wanted to stay there, we're still there. And the landlord was like,
hands off.
Oh, they won't come near. They won't touch us. Like, they know the, you know, somebody looks at me in the wrong way, got a complaint at the RTO about quiet enjoyment, which is one of the clauses. And now I know more than I ever imagined I would want to know about the Residential Tenancy Act. So ask me anything. No, don't, please. Okay. So that's kind of that story of my adventures. So maybe to just take a quick, any thoughts or observations from you folks or questions? Or?
I mean, I guess it seems like you all had a starting point that enabled you to do that. You know, whereas I think of like the context of the kinds of relationships that people have in like that I know now, and it's like, okay, well, like what kinds of relationships do we have with our neighbors or like people that live in the same apartment buildings as us? My partner went through a really similar experience like a year or two ago with the apartment that they were living in, where they were getting evicted on like some bullshit, and like everyone in the building knew it was bullshit, but people didn't have the relationships with each other to resist that. So the fact that there was that point of reference of like people having, or like that starting point of people having relationships with each other because the landlord before didn't totally suck. And so people had been able to afford to live there for like extended periods of time.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, so I guess just thinking about like how things.
Yeah. I think it points at the things that can make it work.
Yeah.
And even now when we, you know, when we sort of go and talk to other buildings who are dealing with stuff, that's the first and main lesson for all of it is you've got to talk to the people around you. You have to actually make that effort to connect around what's happening to all of you. You may not have that history of knowing each other through some other way of connecting, but if you're going to escape and completely run over and victimized by the whole thing, you gotta very quickly form some kind of communicative community. That's the only way.
Mm-hmm.
Or you just go down. You go down one by one, or suite by suite, or floor by floor. I mean, depending on. And yeah, I mean, I think we were very. See, they'd been doing this for years. They'd been evicting people, like hundreds of people, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people, over the years. And then they ran up against. Yeah, we were this oddball situation, but I think we kind of were the. the test, you know, the test case for, well, how do you, you know, how is it possible to deal with this stuff? And it's about talk to people, talk to the person next to you, put up a notice, have a meeting in the lobby, share information. It's, if without that, we're just individuals up against multi-million dollar corporate institutions. And the first time we all went to, the first meeting that we went to the Residential Tenancy Act, or the office, rather, for the first hearing of the first floors, well, I went along with my camera, and in the lobby were three sort of private investigator dash thugs dash ex-cops who had been hired by the landlord to take our pictures and to intimidate us.
What?
So of course I took their pictures, and I really intimidated them, I'm sure. But that's, you know, they can get pretty, you know, and compared to some places, I mean, even that's nothing. So they took our pictures, right, and hassled us. Big deal. In some places, they start shooting at you. You know, it's really, I say, in some places, they can start shooting at you if they don't, if it's like, get out of the building. And
if, camera shooting or shooting?
No.
Okay.
Bang, bang, shooting.
Okay.
And in fact, there's a company formed by some ex-cops who are routinely hired by landlords to intimidate people who are, you know, to stop them from organizing and getting together.
What's the company called?
You know, I'm trying to remember. I'll look for it. I found out about it because after our little mutual camera shooting thing, everybody else went upstairs, and I decided I was going to stay downstairs and kind of, you know, chat these guys up. So I went this thing about, you know, it's so interesting what you guys do. You know, I shoot too, you know, and you know, maybe I could get a job with you or something. So then they started talking about what they do, right? I was like, oh yeah, we got this, and we do, you know. So I kind of found out what, you know, who they were and what they were up to.
But, ICBC will hire people like that to park in front of your place for a week straight,
yeah.
Scaring them off.
Yeah. Because ultimately there's money, it's a lot of money on the table. That's what it's all about. And
Erlyn,
yes.
I ask?
Yes.
There was lawyers involved, and were they, to argue your case in court, were they working for free?
Mostly.
Yeah.
I mean, they were sitting with us. I mean, there are enormous number of legal documents and affidavits.
Yeah.
And to go get an affidavit done is expensive, right? So,
yeah.
I mean, they did all that for free. There were people who were involved with the censorship case and our pals. So,
part of a pro bono association, or did you just get out
there? You know, we did deal with a pro bono, it's called CLASS. Can I remember what that stands for? But anyway, they're doing pro bono sort of community and housing stuff, and one of their people acted as an advisor to us, gave us some time.
I know Pivot gives referrals to lawyers that are doing pro bono work around housing too. We just learned that at the last meeting.
And you mentioned it went to Supreme Court. Does that mean that you did it go straight to Supreme Court, or you needed to go through the earlier stages of the legal action?
Oh, it went to BC Supreme Court.
Oh,
not
okay.
Not the Supreme Court of Canada. The censorship case went to the Supreme Court of Canada, but no, this was the provincial Supreme Court. And no, because what happened is we got a judgment. We got these mixed judgments because they don't use precedent at the residential tenancy. It's not a part of how they operate. So you can have like four identical things come before them, and they can make
it
a completely different decision in each case because they're not bound by a precedent as a court of law would be. There's so many wrinkles of how they get away with this bullshit. You know, it's pretty amazing. So they made a judgment against us, and we appealed to the court for a judicial review of their decision, which almost never happens. Courts don't like to get involved and overturn the tribunal judgments, so you've got to show that they willfully ignored evidence, and you know that they have to have, you know, been really bad in order to get a judicial review.
You feel as if the residential tenancy office in Metrotown, that tribunal, they did willfully ignore evidence and
absolutely, they do it all the time. Yeah.
So it's not a people's advocacy organization.
Oh no, it's a landlord's advocacy organization. And although it's supposed to be arm's length from the government, it's a little mysterious how it came into our hands, but got correspondence between the head of the residential tenancy office and Rich Coleman, who at that time was head of the housing mm-hmm. ministry in the provincial government. So they were like, you know, mm-hmm. anyway, it's a lot of politics and mm-hmm. anyway. Shall I carry on or mm-hmm. any other comments? So this is.
I have a question.
Sure.
I just got here and I actually was coming to pick up screens, but I've heard a lot of talk about landlords, the Residential Tenancy Act. Somebody want to fill me in on what we're having a meeting about, on what we're talking about, because it sounds like it could be potentially interesting and useful.
Yep. You're welcome to continue to join us. This is Erlyn Wiseman, and this group here is meeting as part of a community-engaged media project. So we're creating videos to address the affordable housing crisis. And so we've had a whole series of folks come in and talk to us, and this is them.
Yeah, there definitely needs to be a lot more affordable housing.
It's true.
Yeah.
Indeed, indeed. Well, next time I want to talk about how I see the players in a little bit bigger picture of how this works, specifically in Vancouver and because housing is mostly covered by provincial legislation, it sort of goes on up to the legislature in Victoria as well, so I find it really interesting to hear what Matt talked about that first go. I mean, he's obviously a long-term renter, but in a fairly specific situation with a house and, you know, it sounds like a very cool landlord who he's never sees. I'm coming from a renter's perspective and how I see the, you know, kind of the picture. So it's similar but not quite the same. I think they're, you know, probably complementary in some way. So this section is called "What's the Deal with Housing?" So here's who I identify as the major players in this. So first of all, there's the city. And the city is involved with housing because the city owns land and has social policies and probably most importantly, and I'll talk about this in more detail, has the power to rezone, which is the main tool of operating around land values, affordable housing, tenancy, all of these things. So our current council doesn't seem to be very different from the council that we thought we were getting rid of with the NPA. They seem to be actually kind of doing a lot of the same things. There's a number of official community plans are being developed and written now, there is some unhappiness with the city and what's going on in the meantime with rezoning and development. Another set of players are developers, but also corporate landlords, management companies that manage the big housing institutions, I guess you'd say, and even further behind the scenes are people who are called land aggregators, and they create land banks, private land banks, and their timelines are long. Their timelines are what's going to happen in 15 years, where do we buy large areas of land, what do we invest in? And for developers too, their timelines are very, very long. And typically, by the time a community, and when I say community, I mean a geographic community, gets any like hint of there might be something going on, there are rumors of whatever, it's all over. That all got figured out a long time ago, and now you're on the tail end of it, and this is this is the main issue in a way of how do you develop new ways of dealing with this that actually involve the community in a much earlier stage of these things. So and the third major players, maybe it's all one, are the banks. The banks finance all of this stuff, and so they play. So what they will and won't finance, and how they set interest rates and how they set rates for mortgages, and how they finance people like the evil landlord that we're dealing with. Is crucial to how gentrification, the rise in rents, and so how all that plays out. The banks have a huge role in that, and just in terms of our building, just kind of a snapshot of how it works. There was no rezoning involved, but the landlord, and just from what happened, you got to know this is what went on. The landlord. See, they don't actually have any money. What they can do is leverage money. So so Hollyburn Properties goes to the bank and says, we want to buy this building over in English Bay, and so we'd like you to lend us the money. And what we'll bring to the table is here's a sheet showing the current cash flow from the rentals. Within 3 months. That'll go up by 40%, guaranteed. And they could guarantee it because they know that that's what the residential. We started referring to the residential tenancy office as an eviction factory, because that's who they were working for. They were working for the landlords, and so the landlord could go to the bank and go, "We'll get everybody out of that building, and the rents will go up by 40%, and we'll improve the building too. We'll put in fire alarms or whatever." And the bank would go, "Oh, well, that looks like a pretty good return. Yeah, you go for it. You get rid of those long-term tenants. Yeah, I don't give a shit." Meantime, up in the window in the bank, is the happy family, with how we're supporting the community and all this stuff. Man, I to this day, I just want to kick those windows in when I see that kind of thing, because what they're actually doing is destroying the community. So when the regulatory framework and the big financial institutions and the city all collude, there is so much money to be made that our building was a fluke. That court case was a fluke, and for the most part, it's very, very difficult for any kind of citizen group or initiative to go up against the combined power of these three institutions. In the city, in particular, was supposed to be on the side of the citizens, when they're all cooperating to rip us off and put us out of our housing. So that's the struggle. And for me, I put my efforts to I work in documentary, and documentaries at some level is about saying, here, look at this is happening in our world. Have a look. Yes, I might you know, it's not that it's the truth, but, you know, if you have any trust in the integrity of the filmmaker, you're going to go, oh, yeah, okay, I guess that is really going on. You know, that's what's happening. And so I still feel that this, you know, this is a role I can play, which is to name what's going on and to provide some insight or some analysis as to, like, a reality check. Here's you know, it's not the pretty picture in the window of the bank. Here's what the bank is actually doing. And the stuff I'm doing now has a lot to do with mapping and using locative digital tools to look at social capital in a neighborhood, or, you know, how are we going to live together? And it's the same thing. Let's look at what's really going on. Where are people going? How do they move around? What do they care about? How do they feel when they move through their community? The other thing I should just say is that zoning or upzoning, and we had just an egregious example of what can really go wrong in the West End at 1401 Comox Street, which was a church. I think it might have been a United Church. It was there. That church had been there for 100 years, and the building wasn't huge, and it was on quite a large corner lot. So there was lawns where you could hang out and benches to sit on, and you could always go into the church and, you know, just have a few moments of quiet and thought. And they had various programs, and although it was privately owned in the sense it was owned by the church, it was a public space. Through various things that happened, didn't happen, and around financing, again, the banks. The banks were not interested in, I think it was, they wanted $4 million. I mean, this is peanuts, this is nothing. And the banks just couldn't see their way to giving a consortium of community organizations $4 million to actually build a community resource and keep it as, yes, it might have been, strictly speaking, privately owned, but it would still be a public space. It would be open to everyone, and like the neighborhood houses. And in fact, it's right next door to Gordon Neighborhood House, and so there was discussion of how all that could work. But no, a developer waltzed in, put down the bank's $4 million, they're not their own, and took their business plan to the bank, said, hey, we can put up 30-story tower with 400 square foot apartments in it. You know how many we can cram into that? What? Look at the cash flow. It's going to be here. Well, the bank is like, yeah, okay, great. Here's your, it's nothing. They're hardly taking a chance. In order to do this, however, they have to get the land rezoned. The city has to say, okay, the land is going to be rezoned with a different, they call it FSR. It gets sort of technical in the sense that there are ratios between floor space and the number of units and how high the tower is and et cetera, et cetera. But basically a place, this land that was zoned in a way that said, you know what, if you're going to build something other than the church, if you're going to, you can only build four stories high. And this is kind of from a previous community plan that said the West End should be walkable, it shouldn't have a lot of towers, it should have big setbacks. I mean, these are the community values that were incorporated into the plan. And, well, no developer wants to put up a four-story building. I mean, they just don't. They're not going to make any money. But another key thing to understand about housing in this town, and not uniquely, but very much a Vancouver phenomena, is, it took me a long time to figure this out, but one day I was actually at City Hall arguing, holding forth about something or other, and afterwards I was just chatting with some of the old-time, the people who had been city planners in previous eras, and they were going, oh, and this guy, yeah, and he's selling this, and he's selling that, and it was like the light went on, and I realized the developers in this town they're not building or renting or selling housing. These towers, they're selling views. That's what they're selling. They don't give a shit about the housing. That's how they're making their money. And so is it any surprise that none of it really works? You know, how do you have a, you know, a family with even one kid, let alone two or three, in a 450 square foot apartment, 22 stories in the air, you know, watch your kids in the playground from there? I mean, the whole thing is designed for an economic strata of, you know. So upzoning. That, and of course, as soon as that tower is there, the city now is appraising that land at 7, 8, 10 times its value as it, the church was there for 100 years. Church didn't pay taxes, right? Churches don't pay taxes. So that land sat there as a community resource, didn't pay any taxes, didn't bring wealth, money wealth to the city. It brought social wealth though. But that's never at the table, and that's something that we have to change. So the city, so when all this stuff happens with development and upzoning, the city makes money, the developer makes money, the bank makes money, a lot of money. We're just the cannon fodder, you know? So that's why you gotta talk to each other. Like, we gotta talk to each other, or, you know, we don't have a chance. Just this wealth that's created with this collusion in this process is incredible, and it's very hard to stop. The other, and this is kind of more peripheral, just to mention, things like massive transit infrastructure projects, like maybe the Canada Line, which are typically rushed through during some kind of world expo or sporting event, that's taxpayer funded gift to developers, because now society has paid for the transit element and they need that in order to build. They can't go build out in the middle of nowhere. Nobody's, you know, what are they going to do? I mean, even with highways and so, but
5 minutes from the SkyTrain is a sign that you see on every single
exactly.
development.
Yeah. And there are people sitting in their little bungalows up and down Canby waiting for the $4 million offer for their house, right? I mean, and it's so tempting. I mean, everybody, these processes are so powerful because everybody stands to benefit, except, of course, most of us who want affordable housing. And it's just kind of what you're up against, and the developers rely on, you know, massive amounts of funding from taxpayers in order for them to do their thing. I mean, the developer comes in, plunks down somebody's $4 million in the West End, and then is given permission and is financially rewarded for destroying the community. And the reason why they want to put the tower there is because it's a really great community. It's a beautiful place, it's vibrant, it's lively, there's stuff going on, it's, you know, mixed group, it's all, you know. So they go and they destroy the very things that you know, are making it worthwhile for them to develop. It's such a betrayal of the common good that it should never be allowed. And I'll just segue from that because I should stop talking now. But I'll just quickly some ideas for change. Now, okay, these are politically speaking, these are probably going nowhere, but I think it helps to think about it in new ways. I mean, I always, you know, I say that if you actually go back and look at the sort of legal situation of a French peasant, their tenancy, the terms of their tenancy in the 1200s, they had a way, way more secure and better deal with their tenancy than we do. Way better. It was real hard to get rid of your peasants. Real, you could not just boot them out. And I mean, about the only reason that you were allowed to actually just evict people was something that they called wasting the landowner's treasure, which meant burning down your field if you didn't like what went, or poisoning the well, or whatever. I mean, you had to do something pretty outrageous to get driven from your land and your farm or your whatever. We have much less security of tenancy than they did. So there are other systems, there are other ways to do stuff. But I think one of the basic things, and it's just a way to sort of connect the dots in a larger way, and to figure out where people are coming from pretty quickly too, is to look at do you believe it's not all one or the other, but do you believe that housing should be a commodity that goes to the highest bidder? That's capitalism. Mm-hmm. That's how it works, right? But on the other hand, housing increasingly now is being discussed as a human right, and it is one of the necessities of life. I think these days that's called out as food, clothing, shelter, and medical care. These are the basic things that every human being on this planet deserves to have. So if housing is just up to the highest bidder, it's a commodity. So, but if it's a human right, then it's more, you can think of it more as a social utility. And if you look at a utility model, hydro works for everybody, right? All the risk is spread, there's some proportion between what you pay and what you. And there are hybrid schemes that actually incorporate both of these elements, a capitalist commodity element and a social utility element. And this is what, with, I think, very, very problematic success, this is what the city of Vancouver is trying to do in the downtown east. I don't know that they're succeeding, but they're kind of talking that talk of taking housing out of a strictly, you know, how much can you pay? To an idea of it as something that we all need as a social utility. One of the ways I see it, and maybe this is because I've worked in television and in broadcast industries, is I could see housing being dealt with in the same way that we deal with the public airwaves. Nobody owns, they're owned by the public. I mean, they're owned by all of us. And they are never sold outright to a private developer, if you will, or a channel. They are licensed. And there are conditions of license. And if you screw up, you don't get the next license. And I think that would be an interesting model to look at housing. Like, yeah, you can build your building. Yeah, you can make money building your building. But X number of apartments has to be affordable housing, accessible, sustainable.
Pet friendly.
You got it. I'm working on a mapping project with dog walkers right now. Actually.
Kim and I are getting a cat.
Right. Okay. So there's, that's another way to think about how we could handle housing. In other places. And I'm thinking there's a really interesting history of housing in Glasgow, in Scotland, and typical of a lot of sort of 18th and 19th century housing situations, which were horrible for working people. I mean, you lived in a slum, pretty much. And working people in Glasgow got together, and people literally would pull a quarter out of their pocket once a month to put in to a local housing authority that made decisions with the community about building and people living in community-owned housing. So you have a local housing authority. Now, you could do something like this in Vancouver if you insisted that the transfer of property, of land, and the buildings on them were public. That you insisted on transparency in that, and then work towards a, okay, if you want to sell your property, you got to post it publicly. Everybody has to know that you want to sell your property. And the local housing authority gets first crack at it and will pay you the market value. Yeah, you got to have a real good reason for not accepting that offer. So that gradually a local housing authority, whether it's city or neighborhood by neighborhood, actually controls, owns, in a sense. I don't mean owns in the capitalist sense, but controls and administers and takes stewardship of the land base of their own community. Every meeting I go to with the city, I ask, they're getting really bored with me now, but I say, you know, we need some maps. I'm really into maps, because maps are a reality check, I think. So where can I get that map that shows the West End, the little peninsula there, who owns the land? Can you get me that map? I've been asking for... it's what, 2012? I've been asking for 7 years. I've never seen this map. And they don't want anyone to see the map. Trust me. They don't even want to make the map, because then they don't have to say, you know, they don't have to hide it. It just doesn't exist. I've approached people in the real estate industry too, kind of moles in the real estate, and said, I want a map of it. And they go, well, kind of, but it's pretty proprietary, and it's not exactly, and you know, you can't really tell because a lot of them are numbered companies and stuff. But who owns the city? Who owns the land? How do we know? We don't. It's not transparent, and that's a big part of the problem with how do we deal with it. So I think there should be transparency in the transfer of property. And I believe, in light of everything that's happened at Little Mountain and what's about to happen with the viaduct, is there should be no transfer of publicly owned lands to a private corporation. None. What they did at Little Mountain was an outrage. They destroyed a community. But look where it was. Like, right up there near the park, right? Rich people want to live there. You know? Nice. And that's what they're doing in the West End. They want to turn the West End into a little resort area where you know, it'll be an enclave for the wealthy. And I see this process in the larger sense as that we need to resist the forces that are essentially inflicting a kind of economic cleansing in our communities and economic violence against people who just want a safe, clean place to live. I mean, the more I see what goes on, the more outrageous it seems to me that we have to, you know, struggle to get these basic things. The West End, I know, is being cleansed of anybody who makes less than $80,000 a year. Can't live. You won't be able to live there. It's and so the implications are, well, who doesn't make money? Well, seniors, they live on transfer payments, right? Young families, they have a lot of disposable income. They're raising children. And anybody at a minimum wage job, all of those people are going to be excluded. There doesn't ever have to be a sign. Don't move here unless you've, you know, like, you know, they don't have to do that. All they have to do is put up housing that, in your neighborhood, that you can't afford to live in. Look at the downtown east side. So it's fundamentally of how do we think about these things, and I do believe that that adequate, equitable, good housing is a human right. I'm really happy to be working with you guys.
Thanks, Erin. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
So if you got any questions.